Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 18th of July, 2013, at 4 in the morning. This would be Nav Briefing 74, and the title is Mama Teach Tantra. I've some rather overwhelming feelings as I stand here this morning in the little room where I make these recordings, in the little house in the Serra Nevada of Spain. I have some strong emotions that I can only describe as extremely delicate and immense at the same time. Since the beginning of this shift, which was that Monday when I was in Belgium and I recorded the interview with Coast to Coast, since the very first minutes of this shift, I've been basically vibrating with something that comes from the frequency of Vajrayogini. And I don't actually really know where to start talking about it. So you may find this briefing a little hesitant, a little disjointed in places. I might seem to wander from one thing to another because the truth is I don't really know where to begin to translate what's happening in the enlightenment of my mind, which, as far as I'm concerned, is yours, too. And the particular quality of this enlightenment, which can be associated with Vajrayogini, is it's a tremulous intensity. You might think of rain in the rainforest. You know, the heavy raindrops coming straight down through the air and hitting these leaves. And the leaves are all trembling from the impact of the raindrops. That's the degree of her signature. That's the dynamic quality of her signature, of her frequency. It's all pervasive. And it reminds me of that experience which has often been described by those who have undergone samadhi or powerful moments of enlightenment, satori or samadhi. That is to say that there is no place that you can look where you don't see your own mind and know that it's the Buddha mind. And that knowing can dissolve into a not knowing because there is a samadhi of not knowing. I've spoken of this before. It's called Nirbija Samadhi. Samadhi without seed. That's when you know everything by knowing nothing. But there is also a samadhi with seed, Sabija Samadhi. And that is, you know nothing by knowing everything. And that's pretty close to how it feels to me to be in the presence of Vajrayogini, who is a Nirmanakaya emanation of the planet Earth. And to be in her presence at this moment when her shift is unfolding. So I don't know how I'm getting across here. I don't know what I'm going to say. I have a number of things on my mind, if I might use that quaint expression. And I ask you to consider that. You know how it feels when you have something on your mind. And you know how it feels when you have something on your mind that's compelling, that's like trembling on the edge of your mind. You know, it needs to be said. It needs to find expression. And I can tell you that's how I feel now. So I'm beginning this briefing in a kind of awkward and tentative manner, but I can assure you of something else that's equally wonderful. Just as you can have something on your mind, like I do right now, I have something on my mind to tell you. You can also be on her mind in that same way. She has you on her mind. Now, that's a remarkable thing for me to say, and I didn't plan to say that. By the way, I'm not wearing my sleeping cat headphones tonight. It doesn't seem to be necessary. But I guess you could say I'm transmitting or transceiving the Vajrayogini instruction as it spontaneously forms itself. There's so much I could tell you about her instruction. Mama teach this, mama teach that. I decided to call her Mama Teach. So you've got Vajrayogini, the diamond or adamantine yogini, the adamantine girl of the highest yoga tantras. And you've got Vajravrahi, the diamond sow. And you've got Miss Piggy, as we love to call her, in fond irreverence, and Mama Teach. And boy, oh boy, does Mama Teach. I am really seeing, for the first time in the four, since the four preceding instances of a Vajrayogini shift, I am really seeing how Mama Teach. So I'd like to get that across in this briefing. And I ask you to bear with me here because there's so much more going on right now as I stand here in the pitch darkness of the night. In this little house with two cats. There's so much more going on than I can really even sort out. So where do I start? Well, I have a huge compulsion to tell you something that I realized, I think, in transit. I have to say, by the way, that when I flew from while I was in transit, that is to say from Belgium to Spain, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my flight, just a small detail. I got on the plane, and it was pretty full. I flew an airline I'd never flown before, but I had a comfortable seat, A5, at the window, and to my right were two seats. And into those seats came two young Flemish children, you know, Dutch-speaking Belgians. A young boy of about 10 and his sister, who was maybe 6. She sat beside me, and he sat in the aisle. And I communicated with them a little bit, and this is what the essence of what happened was that I learned that the little girl's name was Sophie, Anne Sophie, to be exact. And Sophie kept looking at me in a remarkable way, which was absolutely without fear. And some curiosity. Now, when children look at me with some curiosity, I'm really encouraged. Because, you know, I don't necessarily look fondly on children. And I don't dote on them in any particular way as pure examples of the anthropos. But there is something about a child that is still unspoiled and innocent and open. And that's how little Sophie was. So I was pretty thrilled to have her sitting beside me. And she must have liked me too, because at a certain point she dug around in her bag and she pulled out this garland of colored paper flowers. And she gave it to me. So I got off the plane in Malaga wearing this garland of paper flowers given to me by a 6-year-old girl named Sophie. And sometime during my transition from my Tonal point of power to my Nahual point of power, I had this realization. This is not necessarily a big tantric revelation. It's just a realization that anyone could have, really. There's nothing esoteric about this. Let's say that it's more of an observation than a realization. Okay, what is it? Here's my observation. Every single human animal on this planet, including myself, was introduced at some time in their life to some idea of God. God, right? At some point, usually early in life, children like Sophie are introduced to the word God, whatever it is in their language, and then they're given a concept or picture of God to go along with that. So, for instance, take an extremely indoctrinating religion of mind control like Islam. Well, there you have it. I don't have to go into the gruesome details. You know that children, from the very moment that they can speak, learn the name of Allah as their God, and then they are given and imprinted with a concept and description of that supreme being, as God is sometimes called, the supreme being, the creator. And it happens to all of us, doesn't it? It happened to me, it happened to you, it happened to everybody who will ever hear my recorded words this evening. So that's the first observation. Everyone on this planet at an early age is introduced, and that's the kindest word that I can use, to the word for God and a description going with that word. Now here's the second part of the observation. It is, without question, completely universal and uniform. Regardless of the different languages with different names for God, regardless of the different cultural settings, whether they be Jewish, Islamic, Hindu, Taoist, well, there's really no Tao, there's no God in Taoism, but Christianity, Catholicism, Protestantism, the whole shebang, it is absolutely uniform and universal in the descriptions of God that have been presented to us, that God has the attribute of omniscience. Omnipotence, God is all-powerful. Omniscience, which means God knows and sees all. So God, by definition, in every single one of these traditions and cultures, is an immaterial spiritual entity that sees and knows everything. That is to say, the beginning of everything, because God is the creator and must know how things began. The middle, because God watches things as they unfold. And the end and the outcome. God knows the outcome. God wills the outcome, and it is God's hand that decides the outcome. And who has not been told this? Find me anyone on the planet, any human animal who hasn't been told this. That is the generic and uniform description of God. Okay? Now here comes the third part of the observation. What would happen in the mind of any young human animal introduced to the concept of God if that child were told to consider, just consider, that God really exists? In fact, there are many gods, but that they are not omniscient, that they do not know everything and know how everything is going to work out. Not omniscient in the sense that they know the results of things that happen in the world or things that happen in the universe at large. What if a child were introduced to the consideration that God doesn't know that? And that God cannot, therefore, control the outcome of events that take place in settings such as the planet Earth. Now, what I'm calling here the third observation is actually more of a suggestion, isn't it? It's a suggestion or a proposal. I propose that children of the age of Sophie be introduced to this concept of God as not omniscient. And the observation that would then come into play would be to see how the child deals with that concept. Because I'm pretty certain that a child who was given that concept of God, and in fact, to make it a little stronger, who was taught that regarding God as omniscient is a mistake, I'm pretty sure that that child, if you observe their growth and development, intellectually and spiritually, as it were, you'd find that they were able to come into their own faculties of reasoning and understanding in such a way that they could see what is happening in this experiment in a way that others can't. You know, the claim that God is omniscient and knows all, and by knowing all, controls the outcome, is a lie. a fiction, a piece of monumental bullshit that has been invented by bearded men who wish to control other people. And the only reason why that concept of the omniscience of God exists is as a pretext for control. Because then those bearded men or non-bearded men and the women who are in the same club with them, because neither men nor women can be absolved from this lie, then they are in a position of saying, well, this is the way it is. God is omniscient, and where we stand for God, therefore we stand in a position of control. We stand in a position of advantage because we are aligned to the God who is omniscient. And of course, they elaborate and embellish that lie in ways which are well known and predictable. For instance, they presume to speak before the world and to the world of what God wants and what God thinks, and they presume to dictate to the world the rules of behavior that come from the omniscient deity, which are in fact just their rules that they want people to follow so that they can have control. That lie of the omniscience of God does more to handicap human NLP and prevent human animals from using their natural faculties to apprehend the nature of this divine experiment that we are in than any single idea that has ever been produced by the human mind. Now, I know that some of you have already divested yourself of that idea, and you have taken on board into your thinking and into your imagination the realization that the Aeon Sophia is not omniscient as regards the outcome of this experiment. She can shut down the experiment. Don't get that wrong. She can shut down the experiment by waking up from her dream. Fortunately, she's not waking up from the dream, is she? She's waking up in the dream. And if that distinction doesn't make your humble Turton a famous man, I don't know what will. But even though she can stop the experiment, close down the experiment, and reboot it anytime she likes, she cannot determine the outcome of the experiment when it's up and running. Now, I know that those of you who live in the Sophianic vision story, who live inside the story and say, stay faithful to the frame of the story, will agree with what I've just said, and that it's not just an idea to you, it's not just a thought that I'm spinning out as mental food, but it is a reality that you live. It is something that you realize about this experiment. No one can see the actual nature of this experiment and its designs and purposes in her terms who does not realize that she is not omniscient and able to control the outcome while it's up and running. Yes, she can shut it down at will, but she cannot control where it goes while it's up and running. Not entirely. Not entirely. And in order to manifest her own dreaming power in this experiment according to the highest desire she holds as an aeon, she requires a measure of human participation. For her correction, she requires a measure of human participation. But that is only the correction of the experiment that is now up and running that ends in 2216 at the end of the kalpa, at the end of the aeonic day. She wants to correct this experiment before the end of the aeonic day, because the aeonic day is the tempo of the experiment as it goes through one phase after another in the consciousness of the aeons. And in the consciousness of the aeons, there is a division of moments of the experiment. So the experiment with Anthropos 10 is in a period called a kalpa, 26,000 years long, and nobody knows how many preceding kalpas Anthropos 10 has undergone on this planet. But what we do know for a certainty is that we are now about 210 years or so, 203 years, I guess, from the end of this day. And she wants to complete her correction by the end of the day, because at the end of the day, she reboots the experiment, you see, into a new kalpa. Now, some of this you know already. I don't know how well I'm putting this together, because I feel really strange this evening. And there's something going on. There's so much going on. So much swirling around since that July 7th event when she coordinated her first and second attentions. I mean, that was truly awesome. And a number of you have reported in of your observations and experiences correlated to that timing. And you all agree that it was awesome. Now, just to complete this reflection about the falsity of the omniscience of God, I'd like to add another small element. I'm just going to put this in a what-if proposition because I'm really not prepared to elaborate on it very much. You know, right now, what's troubling me is that it's not that I don't have enough bandwidth for the transception. My bandwidth is pretty good. But retention and distillation is very challenging right now. And I haven't yet been able to reach the state of contemplation, which is called in the old Sanskrit lingo, dharana, dharana. This contemplation is the state of mind required for me to hold together coherently and lucidly as many elements in a transception as I can gather, okay? And I'm gathering some pretty fantastic elements in this transception. So I'm not really calm enough to put it blankly and frankly, calm enough and concentrated enough to pull this off properly. So I'm only going to mention the second element in a tentative way. But this is entirely new. I have never said this in any briefing before. I have never even alluded to it. And as far as I know, it is entirely unprecedented in any religious or philosophical teaching that has ever been expounded on this planet. And it goes like this. What if the Aeon Sophia is not able to control the outcome of this experiment while it's up and running. Not just because she's not omniscient, but because of another specific factor in the experiment itself. Suppose that the experiment that she set up is set up in such a way that it contains a factor that she can't reach or affect at all. And suppose that the optimal outcome of success of the divine experiment with the Anthropos depends on that factor. So there is, let's say, an inaccessible factor in the experiment that she cannot reach, upon which the success of the experiment depends. So you could say in a way that this represents what? I don't know. I mean, how are you going to paraphrase what I'm saying? Am I saying that there is a kind of handicap, a sealed handicap in the experiment? It's a handicap for the Aeon Sophia. How does this element enter into the experiment? Well, it's there from the beginning because she allows it to be there, obviously. But once she allows this factor, which she cannot reach or affect, to be integrated into the experiment, it operates in the total dynamic of the experiment, giving it a character that she cannot control. This experiment is out of control for a lot of reasons, which we can examine and ponder, you know, the rise of patriarchy, the influence of the archons, the gender rift, the destruction of sexual harmony between the genders when the sacred mating rituals of the goddess cults were destroyed and suppressed, the destruction of the sacred narrative preserved for millennia by the Magian Order. We can look at all that. And that's true. All those are factors why this experiment has gone bad. But one of the factors that's caused the experiment to go bad is a factor upon which the solution of the experiment depends. It's independent of all those other conditioning factors. Those are conditioning factors that bear heavily, obviously, dramatically, upon the outcome of this experiment. And they need to be considered closely. And if you're in planetary tantra and you're living the story, then you consider them. You consider Mephisto. You consider the archonic intrusion. We consider all these conditioning factors, but now let's consider something for the first time, that there is an X factor in the experiment, which Sophia cannot reach or control, and that factor determines the ability of human animals to offer her the measure of participation which can assure that her correction will work by the end of this kalpa. Now, let me see if I can say a little more about this. I'm reticent to talk more about this X factor until I'm sure I have the confidence that I can be impeccable about it, impeccable with it. I just want to leave you with this thought. Consider the X factor, which is, granted, this is an enigmatic notion I'm introducing to you. Consider the X factor by comparison to the endowment. Now, sacred narrative says that when Sophia and Selete designed the genomic plasm for the antipodes in the pleuromic core. They calibrated it like scientists calibrating a chemical solution. Into the chemical base of NuSE, which is nucleic acid, they introduced droplets, let's say, in different proportions of different capacities. Seven particular different capacities. One of them is dianoia. That's what I'm using right now to talk to you, and that's what you're using to listen to me. The skill of language and manipulation of symbolic, mathematical, and linguistic systems of communication is dianoia. So they dosed the antipodes with a very high capacity for dianoia. And we know that we're getting comfortable with the idea, we're familiar with the idea, that they superdosed this antipose with faculties that would operate, would come into expression at a genius level. But they also incorporated into the endowment, through mainly through the contribution of Thelete, that high risk factor of cognitive latitude. No other human animals take risks like no other animals, excuse me, in the total range of species in the biosphere take risks like human animals do, and they take huge pleasure in taking risks. Just think of extreme sports, okay? This is a silly example. So I have the cognitive latitude, and then you have the cognitive latitude imparted by the divine Sophia, which is a reflection of her own nature, which is wisdom, which is learning, a capacity to learn at a genius level. Every human animal who realizes the true power of the antipodes, the true endowment of the antipodes, is a genius. And so there you go. We understand this about the endowment. There are these seven components: the calibration of the endowment, the perinoia, the metanoia, and so forth. Factor X is completely different from that. And factor X is not the sattvic factor, by the way. The sattvic factor is what coordinates and balances into a harmony, into a rhythmic whole, the different functions of the endowment of the antipodes. Okay, that's sattva, rhythm. Now, factor X is neither sattva nor is it any one of the seven components of the calibration. So what on earth is it? Well, I tell you that it is impossible for any human mind to understand what factor X is, and therefore impossible to enter in full knowing and understanding into our role in this divine experiment as long as the imprinting of the omniscience of deity pertains. That idea, whenever and however it was introduced, that lie that was introduced by stinking old men, misogynists and sadists, down to the last man, Jack of them, that idea, whether they intended it to be so or not, operates as a total blind to our seeing what in the fuck we're doing here in this experiment and what we are designed to contribute to life in the universe. Factor X is the key to how the whole thing goes wrong. And you know, it's incredibly simple. It is so simple that it's staggering. And to give you a sense of this complicity, of this simplicity, excuse me, to invite you into complicity with this simplicity, what can I say? I can just say this. When I was on my way back from Brussels, I had one of the greatest realizations about the Sophianic vision story that I have ever had. And that realization is that the corruption and deceit and sadistic, murderous contagion in our world today is not something that happens that gets in the way to human animals living the solution of Sophia's dreaming of the earth. All of that is not something that just comes up out of bad behavior and unfortunate conditioning and gets in the way. That corruption, deceit, and murderous contagion is actually the condition for the solution of the experiment. It's actually what has to happen for the solution to be enacted. It provides the setting for the solution to be enacted. It presents the challenge for the solution to be enacted. Now, I want to make sure that I'm crystal clear in how I'm saying this. So let me just say it and paraphrase it in a different way one more time, and as briefly as I can, as cogently as I can. The corruption and deceit and rampage of murder and greed unfolding on this planet are not obstructions to living the solution. They are the requirements for finding the solution. They are not just in the way. They are in the way because only through those horrible events, through those horrible behaviors, can humanity reach that factor in this experiment which even Sophia herself can't reach because she didn't impart it to us in the endowment. It's not present in our endowment. Now that may sound wrong. I mean, that may sound inconceivable or impossible. How can this factor X not be present in the endowment? How can there be anything that human animals do that doesn't come out of the skills and capacities that were coded into our anthropic plasm? Well, that's a riddle, isn't it? That is a riddle. Factor X is a riddle. And the riddle could be baffling, and it could be so difficult that anyone might just be thrown back into despair and confusion by this riddle. But I assure you that that is not so. because I assure you that the riddle of factor X is already operating in your own mind. It's operating in my mind all the time. It's bubbling in your mind all the time. But it's bubbling and in the minds of, I'm sure, many, many people. In fact, I would say that it is bubbling in the minds of those members of the human species who are capable of snapping out of religious conditioning and engaging in the Sophianic view of life. I would say that this riddle is already operating in the minds of those people. It is certainly not operating in the minds of people such as countless numbers of Muslims around the world who are not and never will be able to break free of their religious conditioning. But among those of us who can, the riddle is already there, but it's there under another guise. It has another name on it. It has a different syntax labeling. It is the riddle of conscience. And one way I would put this riddle is like this. If it is assumed that every human being who is a true human being, a true representative of the Anthropos, has a conscience, then why do so many people act as if they don't have one? You know, the corruption on this planet at the higher levels is being revealed every day, isn't it? The governments are corrupt. It's trafficking in arms, trafficking in children, in bodily organs, trafficking in drugs, trafficking in women. All corporations are evil. The people who run the corporations are all corrupt. They're all gangsters. The international global banking syndicate is a crime syndicate. Banksters are racketeers. The pharmaceutical companies, Monsanto, all the great corporations are criminal corporations staffed with totally corrupt people. And in addition to those who are in the executive and managerial levels of the corruption, deceit, and murderous destruction being carried out on this planet, in addition to those executive and managerial people, there are countless millions of people who go along with what they're doing or who do not resist it, even when they know what's up. And so I would say to you that the very picture of what's wrong with this experiment screams out a riddle. If the human animal has conscience as an innate endowment, and haven't you always assumed that about yourself and others? Then why does it act like it doesn't have a conscience? That's the riddle. And I guess I may as well go whole hog, to use a Vajrayogini allusion, and state the obvious. That factor X is conscience. When the Pleromic gods designed this experiment, regardless of the anomaly that was to come about, in which the Aeons of Fire, one of the designers, would herself become the setting for the experiment. When they designed it, regardless of that anomaly, the one thing that they did not imbue in the human animal to be the main subject of the experiment was conscience. How can you explain the massive corruption in this world, and even down to the smallest thing, people shortchanging each other, people in others in stores, people ripping each other off locally in families, lies and deceits. How can you explain this massive tendency of corruption upon which the self-declared enemies of humanity absolutely rely and of which they take great advantage? How can you explain it if you assume that people have a conscience? What's the point in having a conscience if you don't act on it? Well, I submit to you that you don't have a conscience, and neither do I, unless I show that I do. So if you're standing in the street and you see, let's take an innocuous example of somebody cheating or ripping off another person who's naive, and you sit there and watch this and you don't go and intervene, what would you say? Oh, well, yeah, I have a conscience, but in that instance, I didn't choose to act on it. Well, I say to you, in any instance in which you do not act on conscience, you don't have conscience. Because conscience is existential, not essential. You know, Sartre said that the primary principle of existentialism is what? Existence precedes essence. Now, you know, it's an interesting thing, and I just have to make this little footnote. I don't know where these things come from. But way back when, I can't even remember when it was, in the mid-80s, I guess, I don't even know. I mean, a long time ago, I was reading Sartre. And sometimes I would allude to Sartre when I was giving talks at various conferences or whatever, or talking to students. And I said, you know, existentialism is the bodhisattva teaching of the 20th century. And I just said that. I mean, that's a claim that I made. And I have to say, I think it's true. I really do. And I think that Gaian ethics is a bodhisattva teaching of the 21st century. Okay? And I'm here to tell you that they are very closely related. They're complementary, and the one builds on the other. The point is not to walk around assuming that you have conscience. The point is to show it in those occasions where it is required. And if you enter a required situation and you don't show it, then don't think that you had conscience and you simply failed to act on it. The reality is you don't have any at all. And that's the reality of the corruption of this world. Look at the self-righteousness of human animals who stand there bitching and complaining and whining all the time about the perpetrators and saying, these people have no conscience. Well, neither do the people who are making the observation. They don't have conscience either, unless they demonstrate it existentially. That is to say, situationally. So, in the full spectrum of the human endowment, conscience was not included. It is not a faculty of the anthropos. Shame is shame. And shame is the disposition to conscience. So you can say that we, as an animal of feeling and empathy, and as an animal who knows, like all animals do, what it is to violate boundaries or to have your boundaries violated, that's when you feel shame, This is a constituent of all animal life. And shame is the disposition to conscience, but conscience is not realized unless it is demonstrated existentially. And conscience is the factor X, which the aeons of fire cannot reach or affect. It is the ingredient to be added to the experiment by the human animal. And in doing so, in contributing conscience to the experiment, the human animal realizes not only its role in the experiment, but it realizes the nature of the experiment itself. The nature of the experiment is a tremendous gamble with capacities of genius that are completely dissociated from conscience. And the experiment can only be corrected in collaboration with Sophia's own correction. By bringing factor X into play in the experiment. The corruption of this world, which is breathtaking and can be seen on the large scale of geopolitical events, in the media, in the arts, everywhere you look, as well as down into the granular detail of the neighborhood and the family. That corruption is due to the lack of conscience, the factor X. Why has it been so difficult to see this until now? Well, let me return to my opening point. As long as human animals have their NLP imprinted with the notion that God, who is the creator of this experiment, is omniscient and omnipotent within the experiment, and as long as, going along with that notion, that the human animal feels obligated to follow the rules of God, which are dictated by men who falsely claim access to the Supreme Being, then it is absolutely impossible for a single human animal to admit that they don't have a conscience. But I'm here to tell you, at 5:12 a.m. in the morning of the 18th of July, that I am one human animal who's ready to admit it. I don't have a conscience, except in the moment when I show conscience. Now, you might wonder why it was set up this way. Hey, listen, folks. I am talking about the intrinsic, critical factors in the setup of this experiment as a moral event in the universe. Imprint that on your mind. A moral event in the universe. This experiment is a moral experiment. It's an experiment in morals. And you might ask, well, why is it set up that way? Why don't they give you the capacity for conscience like they give you the capacity to speak, and then you can, you know, decide whether you want to use it or not? I mean, what I'm saying is something so wild as to say that, oh, I don't have the capacity to speak like I'm speaking these words now. I only have it when I'm speaking, but when I'm not speaking, I don't have it. Well, that's obviously not true, because when I'm silent and not speaking, I still have the capacity to speak, don't I? Not so for factor X. When you are not acting on conscience, you don't have conscience. Well, why would they have set it up that way? Well, it's very simple. For freedom. For the freedom of the experiment. It's an essential factor in the freedom of the experiment. And freedom, by the way, is one of the themes of existentialism. One of the central themes. You know, you are not free not to be free. You are condemned to be free. These are existentialist cliches, aren't they? How does factor X, being the absence of conscience and being the point in the experiment that even the Aeon Sophia herself cannot reach or affect, how does that factor supply the conditions for freedom? Well, if you had conscience as a faculty, like speech, or even a faculty of vision, or a faculty of, let's say, discernment, you would be compelled to use it all the time. But there can be no compulsion in freedom. You would be compelled to use it all the time, just like you're compelled to use the faculties that you have, aren't you? So there's a certain compulsion to use the seven faculties in the endowment of the genomic plasm of the Anthropos. Why? Simply because it is of the nature of life to express itself. But freedom requires that conscience be not expressed in that way, but that conscience rest on a different dynamic, which is the dynamic of what Sartre called le néant, nothingness. You know, the Buddhists talk a lot about nothingness, the void, shunya, shunyata, and so forth. I don't think they got the point that nothingness is not about consciousness. The void is not the nature of consciousness. The void is the nature of freedom. And the void is also where it all goes down the tubes, isn't it? Well, what am I doing with myself this evening? You know, here it is at 1 hour and 3 minutes. I wasn't even going to go there. I was going to talk about what Mama teach. But I guess I can say, and I can say this happily, Mama teach freedom. Mama teach freedom. You know, I don't have my book by Elizabeth English, which is entitled Vajra Yogini. Now, there's a book that'll set your head spinning. I have it somewhere down in Ambergene, I guess. But I do have a copy of Buddhist Goddesses of India by Miranda Shaw. And there's a chapter on Vajra Yogini. And do you know what the subtitle of that chapter is, my friends? Her dance is total freedom. Mama teach freedom. And this is what Mama teach. The basis of human ethics is found and owned when you know that conscience is no possession or faculty, but only something you show in the act of expressing it. It's like water that runs through your hands. And you can hold up your hands while the water is running through them and drink some of the water running through your hands. But this water of freedom you can't hold in your hands. No one holds conscience. No one, no human animal has conscience. Except in the freedom of owning it. That's what Mama teach. I'm going to round this off. I don't know what I'm doing here, folks. This is a classic example of a NAV briefing that just took its own direction. So I don't know. I just have to wrap it up in the best way I can. And two things come to mind. One of them, just off the top of my head, is the call sign for Vajrayogini. You know, you're familiar with the idea of a call sign, because we use a call sign to get together and align our NLP frequencies to channel 16, right? So there's a call sign for channel 16, very specific kind of call sign. And it never occurred to me to think, well, do all the Dakinis have call signs that correspond in an NLP coding to their frequency? Well, I don't know, but she does. And I can tell you what it is. It's VJY651. That's the call sign of Mama Teach. And so this is how you sign to onto her call sign. You take your right hand and you put the thumb and finger together. The tips of the thumb and little finger, excuse me. And that leaves you three fingers, right? You hold the three fingers up and you separate them slightly. And you look at them and you say, V, J, Y. Look at the three fingers. And then after you say that, you turn your hand away so that you look at the back of your fingers. And you say, 651. Because signing the frequency is more effective than merely repeating it verbally or repeating it subvocally. Signing is a mudra. You sign into her frequency with this mudra. Remember to hold your fingers equally apart. Why would Vajrayogini reveal her call sign at this moment in time? Well, this is my guess. And those of you who are on board for me and with me, oh, I love that. You are on board for me. You are indeed. And with me are ready for the biggest wave that ever came across the bow of the mothership. That wave began to break on the 7th of July. And there is no way yet for human imagination to be even large enough or half large enough to assimilate what comes in that wave. On this journey, moment by moment, that is something to be revealed. But I can say right now what I see in that wave that breaks over the bow of the mothership. I see that consequent to the coordination of her first and second attention on July 7th, that the Aeon Sophia, transmitting through the frequency of Tantra Mother, can directly instruct humanity in the way to freedom and in the way to show conscience in both correction and non-correction scenarios. And that is such. In the follow-up to this briefing, number 75, I'll go more into detail in what I'm getting through DI in the specific intel regarding how Mama teach.